This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got our good sponsors for the show. That's our friends at Jamf Software, makers of the Jamf Pro management suite for iPad, iPhone, Apple TV, Macs, you name it, they can support it. So we'll tell you more about that as the show goes on. Bradley, what's going on?
How's it going?
Yeah.
Beautiful day, last show of 2017. Mm-hmm. We are quickly wrapping up the school year. By the time this show airs, we will have just 3 days left. We are getting out a bit late this year. It's just the way that Christmas falls, being on a Monday. So, yeah, our Christmas programs are all done, and those all went off without a hitch. And we tried something new this year with them. So we have, for the past probably 5 or 6 years, we have live streamed them on the internet, and we have recorded them, and we went away from selling DVDs. Actually, sales were much better when we sold DVDs. I don't know why, but the production involved with like doing the DVDs is so much more, because you've got to, like, if you don't sell them that night, like, it's really, you're just not going to sell them. So you're trying to like quickly finish the program, run and master a bunch of DVDs, and we have like one of those DVD cloning machines, and it's just not worth it. And so it cost us about $600 to do the live stream production, and between the two programs. And so what we've typically done in the past is like sold digital downloads for $10 a program. And like I didn't buy them because I already had the files, but like if I was a parent, I would buy them just to have them. I mean, I throw them into my iCloud photo library, and they're 5 gig files. That works fine. But we would probably sell enough to make back like a little, probably 40% of the cost. And, you know, which is fine. But so this year I said, you know what, like let's try a different tactic. Let's like give it away for free and ask people. Say, we told parents like, hey, this costs this much to do this. If you found that valuable, or you have enjoyed keeping this download, you know, please make a donation. And with the donations were more than the sales. And so that was interesting.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Some people would pay way above what you would charge for the.
It is. Like, that was the thing. Some people would, like, you know, drop 25 versus normally paying 10 for a digital download. And so, so that I think we'll probably kind of keep doing that. And it's just kind of easier. It's just like from an accounting perspective, it's just easier to do that. It's easier to handle those as donations than like, you know, program sales.
Yeah.
But we did stream them. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, it's an interesting thing that with teaching or with doing stuff like that in school, where some things, you know, like you've talked in the past about like your lunch billing program or something, you're selling that just to parents, okay? And parents are generally, at this point in history, they're relatively tech savvy. Most of your parents will be on social media. They'll be used to buying things online and so on. But some things in school, they go to grandparents, and things like the downloads and things like that. That DVD was probably something that was kind of handed around the family. And we often have this discussion when it comes to report cards, where, you know, some people will sort of come to your school and they'll say, hey, you buy our digital report card platform and stuff like that. And we found in our school, at least, that people want a physical report card so they can give it to grandparents as a kind of, because in some cases grandparents are helping pay for the school fee, and it's kind of like one of the few things that people get home that's tangible apart from school photographs that they can actually give to grandparents and say, hey, look, this is what actually happens at that school. So it's a tricky balancing act, isn't it?
Yeah, we don't do physical report cards, but there is an option, like in our student information system, when you view them, it basically opens up a PDF inside of a window, and there's a print button. So I imagine a lot of them get printed, because I know they do, because like when we go to the next year, parents don't have the option to see the previous year, and we don't do that like in the summer until like, you know, in the end of June. I often have parents email me and say, hey, can you send me the PDF to these report cards, which obviously we do. It's nice. Our system has a way you can like literally type in their email address and just hit email, and it generates it automatically. But yeah, you're probably right. And a lot of it too, I wonder if like parents are using their own phones and just like, you know, taking pictures and taking videos. Yeah, I mean, basically, a Jerry Seinfeld bootleg. Because I mean, I'm sitting in the back in the sound booth, and you do see like iPads and phones. Like, because there's a part of me that says, like, look, we are recording a much better quality of this. Like, and when we have a sophisticated setup, because it's the church's setup. So, like, the mics, it's not like there's mics recording the speakers. Like, the mics are
straight off the desk.
Piped through. Yeah, I mean, like, so, like, the recording is, like, straight off the system. And so it's not even trying to catch them, like, you know, live. I mean, it's a very high-quality stream with, like, you know, five or six cameras, multiple angles, and we're panning around. I mean, it is good. It is worth the $10. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, people are just like – and I guess if your kid didn't have a solo, how many times are you going to watch it?
But, yeah. That's the truest thing that's ever been said in this podcast, I think.
True, it's very true. So one of the things we didn't do new this year was we did a live stream inside of our app. And of course, I've never really talked about this on the show, but we have an app now.
Okay.
And I did not obviously code it because A, I can't do that, and B, I can't do that. But we went with a platform called Subsplash, and they typically do get church apps, and it's like our church has an app, and basically, like, it's a template type system. But and that's been the news a little bit recently because Apple has kind of put the kibosh on a lot of those template based things. But Subsplash is okay. Like, they're one of the okay ones. I mean, I think what this was going is like going after like the bottom of the barrel type things. Yeah. Where I don't even know a good example, but just basically like low quality, not well designed, et cetera, et cetera. But Subsplash is like high quality, everything, all the graphics are custom. Like, I made all the graphics myself for the school one. And basically, it's not a real complicated app. We don't have tons of content in there. Like, so the main tab is, we call it school news. And all that does is like link off to like our website. So like, there's first grade news, second grade news. And every Friday that gets updated with like what's happening for the next week. Like, you know, hey, here's what's coming up, you know, assignment wise, here's what's coming up project wise. And so like, it does support push notifications. So like every Friday when all those pages are updated, I just send out a push notification like, hey, school news and class overviews are updated for the week. And, you know, like, we probably have, I think I have like 200 people subscribed to the push notifications. So I feel like that's pretty good. Then there's another tab that has our live stream on there. So when we're live streaming the programs, that tab is basically there. The cool thing is I can actually remove the tab after the programs are over it without requiring an app update. So it kind of updates on the fly.
So it's loading this whole configuration. Yeah.
It's very much, you know, it doesn't work offline. The app doesn't. And so it's basically the streaming platform we use is called StreamMonkey. And so like, I basically have like an embed code that drops in there. And then the another tab we have is a calendar, and that's basically like our main school calendar is hosted on Google Calendar, and so it's basically like an iCal feed essentially. Mm-hmm. And so that has kind of our day schedule, because we are on a 6-day rotation where, like, for the kids' fine arts schedules, like, you know, it's day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6. And obviously, like, if day 1 is on Monday this week, it'll be on Tuesday the next week, and then so on. Yeah. Then we post our lunch calendar or our lunch menu on the calendar as well. So it shows like, you know, hey, tomorrow's chicken nuggets, for example. And parents love that because they can easily just pop up in the app, see what they're having for lunch today, see if their kids are going to eat it or not, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Also post our sports schedules on there. So we have basketball team, soccer team. So like, all those games are on there. And then we have a blog. So our school blog on our website gets piped in there in its own tab. It's you know, using RSS. And then there's just what we call a connect tab. It basically has a link to give, a link to our website, a link to our school store where you can, you know, do things like buy lunch tickets and things like that. And then it has links to our social media pages, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And then there's just a, you know, view map, which is like, hey, just shows us our school on a map. Again, not a whole lot in there. I mean, obviously, like, if you're a church, they have a whole media section, and they have, you know, you can have built-in Bibles, built-in reading plans. Mm-hmm. And I did add a tab for our programs. So like the programs that we are posted on Vimeo, and I just embedded them inside of a like a media item inside of the app. And so if you wanted to, you could watch the Christmas programs right inside of our app, like obviously after the fact as well.
Sure.
And so yeah, that's it. It wasn't hard to do. Like, there's a setup fee. It's a couple $100, I think, for them to kind of get you set up. We got a discounted one because I already manage the church's app as well, so I didn't really need all the training. And I just made some simple branding in Pixelmator. I just like grabbed our – so like the school news section, I made a little header with our paw print logo. It just says, you know, BBS News, like something real simple. They give you all the image sizes. I had it built in a couple hours. Everything was in there. They submit it to the app store. They handle all that. and it had all the updates. Obviously, like most of the content you do is posted, is kind of done on the fly. And then, like if you want to change your icon or all that, you submit branding to them. And then every time they update their app, kind of app platform, your app gets submitted. So, like right now, we don't have iPhone 10 support natively. So whenever they do that, they'll publish all of their apps at the same time.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So anyway, we pay $80 a month ongoing. So it's really not that expensive, and it's just an. I mean, it looks really cool because like we can send out push notifications. I feel like that really makes it look like we know what we're doing.
Mm.
If you, I mean, as weird as that sounds.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're still very much kind of in the MailChimp world for dealing with parents. The more you're saying there, Bradley, the more I'm thinking, that sounds quite an interesting idea. Maybe we should have a think about that as well. I mean, we kind of get some of that by doing other kind of clever things with configuration profiles. Like all of the iPads that we deploy to kids, we subscribe to the school calendar with a configuration profile, for example. But obviously, you know, a good idea would be if we had such an app to send that out on the kid's iPad as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's a neat little system, and it works. We have an iPhone app and an Android app. It covers all those, and I actually think a Windows mobile app, oddly enough. And you can pay extra and have an iPad native app and an Apple TV app. Obviously, like for the church, the Apple TV app is really clutch. But like the church's Apple TV app is really nice. Obviously, we don't have a need for that.
Sure.
But again, we just went with the iPhone and the Android app because we figure that's the place most people are using it. Yeah, it works well. It's really easy to manage. And it's called Subsplash is the company. And then it's a whole web interface. You don't have to know any code at all.
Very nice.
So next, another thing we did this fall was we launched a new website. We did that on Squarespace. It was, I love WordPress for all it can do, and the plugin ecosystem is fantastic. Lots of good things about it, but overall, I felt like Squarespace gave us I can make things look the best on Squarespace.
Yeah.
Like I feel like I have more control over the content and how it kind of translates to mobile. We paid a video person to come in and shoot kind of a video background. So on desktop, there's a video background that plays. Just it's easy. We didn't have to pay anybody. I mean, I did it myself. We're paying like $200 a year for the hosting. And we moved off of RenWeb's built-in platform. We liked it. It was fine, but we kind of wanted something that we could have a little bit more of a marketing feel and could do some things. And Squarespace was the best platform there for us. So, yeah, I did that. So, yeah, busy fall for me. New app, new website. And yeah.
Yep. I feel like I'm about a year away from doing a new website for us. We've been on Weebly for a few years now, and it's okay, but I don't love it. You know, it's kind of what I feel about Weebly. Squarespace, I know, like you, because it's my website's been on Squarespace for years. We've had a Squarespace site in the past, actually, but it was the decision was made to move to Weebly a while ago. But because it had integrated blog engine in it at the time, which other options didn't have, so yeah. That's another job for another day, but I think we're going to do that.
Squarespace is hard to manage on iOS.
Yeah,
So that is what it is. None of them are great.
Most WordPress platforms are, aren't they?
Yeah, well, a lot of it's just dragging, especially on Squarespace, you're dragging content inside of a web browser, and I guess they just haven't felt the need to make it work well on an iPad. Obviously, you can blog on a phone, and that's fine. It works well. We're fairly happy. I mean, we got a lot of good feedback from parents who really like it. The nice thing is too, like, you know, maybe this time next year, I can just put a new template in and give the site like a whole fresh new look without having to really rebuild it again, content wise.
Good idea.
Jamped 10. We're kind of doing a year 2017 roundup as you guys can hear. Jamped 10 launched. I have spent a few weeks using it. I love the design. It kind of takes everything you love about Jamf and Jamf Pro and gives it a fresh new look. So big thumbs up for me, working well. And since iOS 11.2.1 dropped today, I've gotten 2/3 of my deployment already done. So it's really nice.
Yeah, it's definitely working a lot better on iPad and iPhone, particularly iPhone. I think Jamf 9 it worked, but it was pretty rough on a phone. And Jamf 10 definitely way better than that, and also fixed a lot of kind of long-standing annoyances on the iPad as well. So running the whole show from iOS is a whole lot easier now as well.
Yeah, I mean, I frequently kind of trigger configuration profiles from my phone, so that is much, much easier now.
Yep, yep. All good.
Let's see. Next thing. So I had a major issue with my Mac last week. I installed some iTunes update. iTunes stopped launching. It kept telling me it was in the process of installing, even though it wasn't. So I decided to restart my Mac, and it proceeded into an endless reboot of kernel panics. And so that was fun.
Because, of course, that's exactly what you expect to happen when you update your music player, isn't it?
Bingo. Yeah, it wasn't even like a huge upgrade. So I started, I said, okay, how am I going to recover from this? Like, obviously, like, I have multiple clones, multiple Time Machine backups. My clone was newer than my Time Machine backup by like a couple hours, but it just felt I started to restore the clone, but it just felt slow for some reason. You know, obviously, I booted from the clone. I was restoring back. I thought, you know what? I'm just going to wipe this thing, use my Sierra boot drive or High Sierra boot drive, and I'm just going to restore from Time Machine. And that seemed to go faster. Maybe the drive is faster. I'm not sure if my clone maybe isn't USB 3. But what stunk was my High Sierra USB drive was on 10.13.0, but my Time Machine drive was on 10.13.1. So it's like, okay, let's try this. Well, the cool thing is the Time Machine Restore could tell that and upgraded my Mac. You know, at that point, it recognized, it was, you know, it wasn't running off the USB drive at that point. It was actually running off the Mac hard drive
because
it
recovery installed partition, the OS. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it knew, so, hey, we've got your Time Machine is newer than what I have. So it did a kind of an inline update, which seemed to work well. And, yeah, all worked well. I had some things in iCloud Drive that had done since the Time Machine backup. And obviously, like, that, I was like, okay, how's that going to work? Is that going to, like, overwrite the changes? Is it going to think what not having it is newer? And that's always the fear. But it worked well. I mean, like, there was probably 10 documents. It just downloaded them right back. Opened up Photos library. It had to do some, like, you know, checking for, you know, upgrading database or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it gave me some weird error at the end, which is kind of terrifying and always was half the reason I did not want to use Photos because it is a database.
Yeah.
But I hit OK. I shut the app down and restarted it, and all my stuff was there. It was fine. And obviously during that time, like, my iPhone was fine. So I knew worst case I would just have to, like, delete the database, create a new database, and let it download everything.
Yeah, yeah. Quite often you see that, like, you know, the stuff is actually safe in the cloud, but your local view of it takes quite a long time to catch up with it.
Yeah, but yeah, all my syncing, kind of everything merged back well. I would love to, like, do a fresh Mac install. Like, I did that with iOS, like, a year ago, and I have not done that with my Mac in, like, 5 years, and I would love to do that, but I don't know. That just seems like it's going to take a while.
Yeah, I suppose it depends how many customizations you have and how well configured they are. I mean, I will be doing a fresh update on Mac relatively soon.
Ah, so let's talk about your new Mac.
Yeah. This is a weird turn up for the books. But, you know, we talked in the last show, Bradley, I was kind of debating between, what was it I was looking at, 15-inch MacBook Pro or an iMac? I eventually came down on the side of the iMac and have ordered and will pick up in a couple of days' time a 27-inch 2017 iMac 5K with pretty much all the toys you can get on it. Not the biggest SSD unit. I went for the 512 SSD, but I went for the fast processor because, well, it's not the reason I bought the machine, but one of the jobs is there's a cupboard full of DVDs in this house that need to get encoded and put in Plex and then thrown away for the last time, which I've tried to do a couple of times, and everybody's been, oh, we've spent a lot of money on those DVDs. And I'm like, we don't have a DVD player in the house anymore, so what are we going to do? Why are we keeping them in the cupboard? We went with the faster processor, the i7 processor for that, amongst other things. Bunch of RAM, 27-inch iMac lets you put in third-party RAM, so I did that. And joy of joys, since I was last on the Mac, there's now a wireless keyboard with a numeric keypad that you can get again. So that's an old friend that's coming back as well.
Because you know what your bottleneck on this DVD ripping is going to be. It's going to be like the DVD drive itself.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm sure it's USB too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my job is going to be pretty much teach the children how to extract all the DVDs, and then I'll batch job the encoding later.
I mean, have you ever thought of that? Just like, I don't know. I mean, how many do you have? Like 10?
No, like 100.
Oh, I was thinking, would it mean like there's a part of me that's like, if it was like 10 or less, like just buy those on iTunes because then you would have the 4K version.
Yeah, no, no. I had children before movie downloads were a thing, unfortunately. So the majority of all of our movies are still in the cupboard.
Yeah, with the Movies Anywhere set up, I am much more okay with buying movies digitally now. Because I know, like, I know if I buy it on iTunes, I have it on Amazon and vice versa.
Yeah, so. I don't think that's a thing in the UK. I don't think that even applies.
Yeah, that really stinks. I mean, I'm assuming you know about that, right?
I don't think so. I've seen no marketing about it whatsoever.
So there's this thing, I think Disney made it, and because there's been a way in iTunes for like the past 3 or 4 years where if you bought like a movie from Disney's website digitally, you would have it on iTunes, and I think it was like called Disney Movies Anywhere. Now it's just called Movies Anywhere, and it supports like all but one studio, and I'm sure that'll come. So basically this Movies Anywhere website, you like log into it, make an account, and you click a button and it like throws you to Amazon. You say, okay, this is my Amazon credentials, and it kind of authenticates. Same thing with Google. Same thing with Vudu, V-U-D-U, which is owned by Walmart. And then iTunes. Like I think it throws you into the iTunes app. And so then basically if you buy a movie on – oh, and Google Play. So if you buy a movie on Google Play, you have it available on Amazon and on iTunes, and then vice versa.
Interesting. That would be nice to have. I'm sure we don't have that here. I mean, what I've done since we get into using Plex was really – I've almost sort of gone back to buying DVDs and then ripping them and putting them in Plex rather than buying them digitally. You know, I'll buy digitally for convenience and speed if I'm in a hurry for something. But if I'm looking for sort of archival things, things I really like, I'm sort of going back to buying them on DVD and then putting them in Plex.
Yeah, my only concern with that, with like 4K HDR, is I don't want to be storing like 25 gig files.
True, true. Yeah, that's going to be a thing. I mean, I think eventually we're looking at, you know, everything streams in, when you're dealing with that resolution. I mean, I think some of them... Well, is it true that in iTunes, if you buy a 4K movie, you can't actually download it to a Mac? Is that... I'm pretty sure there's some tight restrictions on 4K files.
I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure. And I guess the I know on the Apple TV, obviously, you can't download it. So I'm not sure in the slightest.
I think you can play it through iTunes. Like if you've got, say, a 4K or a 5K computer... You can play it through iTunes, but it's always streaming, and then you can't like download it for local storage if it's a 4K. I heard that anyway. I'm not sure that's absolutely true, but that was something I heard was possibly happening.
What would be nice is if there was like movies match, like there were the music match, where you could like say, "Hey, here's my Plex library. Match all this stuff with what's in the iTunes store, and give me access to it natively." That would be
cool.
I'm sure that would be really expensive.
Yeah.
But that'll be a good Mac. I'll have to have some pictures when you get that.
Should be fun. Yep.
We discovered, and obviously I'd heard about it before, but we actually found a use for it, the Puffin browser, where it's got like a built-in flash player. It's basically the remote. It's remoting into somewhere and launching it. And everything I've read, I mean, back in the day, people were trying to do this for like games and stuff, like flash-based games. And obviously, like that's probably not going to work well. And what we had was a service we use called Children's Progress, which is like an assessment tool. Mm-hmm. They don't have an iPad app, and it uses Flash, so terrible. And we always made it work with Chromebooks, and just we always made it work when we had to do these assessments. And we're doing it like 18 kids at a time. But I had this wild hair, like, hey, let's try the Puffin browser. So we got the free one, tried it on one, worked great. So we just bought the paid Puffin browser because there's no ads. And, like, rock solid, super cheap. I think it was like $4 an app, and we bought like 20 of them. Super, super cheap and works well. So if you have an assessment tool that is Flash only, maybe give the Puffin browser a chance.
Very good. Very good. Yep. So iOS 11 point whatever, that is starting to really grind my gears. You were saying that you are up to, what, 30%, 40% deployed for the version that just came out today.
Yes.
But
as
we were saying off air, Bradley, the difference is that in my school, all of our iPads have a passcode on them. Well, not all, but most do. And in your school, none of them do. And you have a much easier life than I do.
Yeah, because, I mean, I manage 164 iPads, and I'm down to 46, not on iOS 11.2.1, and that came out hours ago.
Yeah, I mean, today I finally got down to single figures of devices on iOS 11.2. I had 6 left to go, and 11.2.1 came out, and that reset the clock again. I mean, what we've been trying to do is there's a recommendation from some cybersecurity department of the government that you should install major software updates within 14 days of release. So we've been kind of pushing on this, and I set up a profile in Jamf that would basically block out every single app except the settings app. And this was my way for, because, you know, all I, what I can do in Jamf is I can say, right, prompt this iPad to download the update and then restart if possible. But if a passcode is set, it can't restart by itself. The user's got to interact with it. And a lot of kids will just cancel that because it's not convenient whenever it happens. Which, I mean, I get that, it's fine. But what I was kind of lacking was, that was the carrot, but then the stick was, you know, how do I get you to update if you just continually refuse to do it? So what I've done now is I've set up this profile that basically sets, it blacklists all apps on the system except the settings app. And when the 14-day window is up, I have a group, a smart group, which is, you know, is a student iPad and is on a version less than 11, whatever the current version is. And 14 days after that, I will scope that group into my blocking profile. And that will cause some people to kind of go dark across the school. And then that usually brings them running to me, and then I explain to them why. But what I've been doing in the meantime also is on our notice board, there's a new poster goes up whenever there's a release that says, current version of iOS, released on this date, update by this date, otherwise please see me kind of thing. And that has mostly worked. Most people have done it. But I was looking at the release cycle for iOS 11, Bradley, and there have been 9 releases of iOS 11, and only 2 of them have actually been in the wild for more than 14 days. We had, what was that? iOS 11.03 was out for 20 days, and iOS 11.2 was out for 16 days before it got updated. So in the course of from mid-September to now, we have had 9 iOS releases, some of them only being out for 7 days, you know, and in times past, we've sort of said, you know, Apple needs to increase the speed of their software update cadence. And I'm like, yeah, but not like this, you know. It's one thing to have a fast release cycle, and it's great that they can release things quickly if they need to, and they have needed to. But the process is still so heavyweight that it's like you can't have one without the other sort of thing. We need a lighter weight way to update iOS on all of our devices.
Well, in your situation, what I wish is you had the option to say, update this, like on the, with the passcode, like update this next time it's basically plugged in and asleep. You know, like, you know, it's like, yeah. So theoretically, like that night when they plug their iPad in, just update. Like update the next time, no user interaction for an hour, but on power or something.
Yeah. The problem with this is, and I'm going to butcher the exact technical details here, but you know how if you have a passcode or PIN code on your phone, in order for it to start installing the update, you need to put in your passcode. And what's happening there is that, I think my understanding is that something happens where, like that password is stored as an encryption key so that the iPad can then sort of unencrypt itself to boot up and do the software update. And then when it boots up again, it needs your encryption key again to encrypt your file or to decrypt your files. So it's something to do with, you know, everything being encrypted on storage, and how does it come up to do a software update if it doesn't have the key that it needs to boot up enough to do the software update without user interaction. So there's a kind of a bit of a chicken and egg situation there, I think. And the actual details of that are in the iOS security guides. You can look it up if you want to. But that's my understanding for why it is that you can't actually just say, hey, forcibly remote reboot this iPad. But I think it would be nice to have a little bit more help to kind of persuade people to do this rather, or really force people to do it. You know, it's the kind of thing where it's great that I can push the package to people's devices, and it's great that I can do these other things, but wouldn't it be nice if you could just say, look, iOS, please would you just keep bugging the user, and then eventually after 13 or 14 days, just force them to do it rather than making it something that you have to sort of build yourself and manage yourself.
There's a part of me that I love the thought of what's new in iOS 12, but there's a part of me that would say next summer comes iOS 11.6, which is like a major point release to iOS 11, and a major point release to macOS High Sierra. Like, let's just take the foot off the gas software-wise a little bit.
Yeah, I get why they don't, but I also don't get why they don't. Do you know what I mean? This release cadence, like many of these updates have been for like individual single bugs. And I suppose it speaks to the sort of high priority nature of what went wrong in some of these. You know, you've got your keyboard autocorrect bug was a whole point release, and then the one that came out today was for the HomeKit lock vulnerability, and then one was about crack as well. So many of these are like individual security issues that are coming to light, and they're being made a big noise of in the press, and then we're being left to kind of turn over the whole fleet. And you know, for when you're in a fully controlled situation without passcodes, that's not too difficult. But in every other situation, and I can only imagine what it's like for a business with 10,000 iPhones pushed out, you know, how are they forcing people to do that? It's quite tricky, and we could use a little bit more support from the OS to do that.
Before we move on, let's thank our sponsor for tonight. It's the great folks at Jamf. Jamf Pro is the best solution for deploying, managing, and securing your Apple devices. Over 3 million students are empowered by Jamf every day. Bring learning to a whole new level for your students and teachers by providing the tools they need to be successful in the classroom. Start a free trial of Jamf at jamf.com. Thanks to Jamf for sponsoring Out of School. All right, so going to kind of recap what other things we saw in 2017 and kind of their importance. Everybody Can Code was something that was kind of new this year. Mm-hmm. We saw what Swift Playgrounds 3 was launched this year, and it was our first year using it, and a huge fan. We've talked about it on the past show, but I am a big fan of the curriculum, and it's free.
Yep, I'm into my second year of teaching this with a new class, and it's really interesting. It's very interesting as well to see how a different set of kids come to it and how I teach it differently the second year round, but I still believe that, you know, everyone can code, and the curriculum that they teach there is it's one of the best curriculums I've ever seen for teaching children to program, and Swift is a good language for doing it as well. It's not perfect, but it's as close to perfect as I've ever seen. I mean, lots of people are teaching in Python, which in my view is an absolutely terrible teaching language for students. I think it's just, I think a lot of people are using it because it's popular and because there are books about it, you know, but if you look at it from a consistency point of view or a readability point of view, it's a whole lot more difficult to manage than something like Swift. So yeah, huge fan of Everyone Can Code. I'm just hoping, Bradley, that Apple continue to put effort behind it and they don't sort of slow down, or we did that effort and now everybody's moved on to some other app or something like that. So my fingers are crossed on that one, but I have unfortunately noticed like some of the updates to the books have been a little bit glitchy. I don't know if it's an iOS 11 problem or if it's an app problem or if it's a book problem, but we're seeing some weird kind of visual artifacts where, you know, the characters won't turn properly if the student commands them to turn in code, or weird things like the character walks through a wall and things like that. So hopefully those can all be addressed relatively quickly.
Next is the files ecosystem on iOS 11, and this was obviously new with iOS 11, where storage providers would have equal access, like, you know, to users like iCloud Drive. And this kind of was my inclination to ditch everything but iCloud Drive, and that's gone well. The only thing I miss is shared folders, but I haven't really noticed. I've been using that a whole lot more, and I haven't had Dropbox installed in months, and I think I've logged into the web interface one time to share something in a folder. But Google has implemented this as well, but it's sort garbage. I mean, it's I wouldn't rely on it. I tried it once. It was really buggy. I tried it after every update. It's still not great, and so I end up just using the Google Drive app. Yeah. Dropbox, the few times I tried it after the release was launched, seemed to work well, much better than Google.
Yep.
I'm really excited about that kind of whole ecosystem going forward.
Yep. I mean, I was excited for it to come, and I'm still excited for it to come whenever it does come. I mean, I think as with things like, if you remember, you know, when the share sheet got actions and things like that, and we were able to do stuff like that, it was kind of a year before things like split screen and the share sheet all kind of came to fruition. And I think what we've got with the files app is we're in a similar situation, but people have kind of got something out early. But in the case of the Google one in particular, it is genuinely terrible. I mean, it's unclear to me whether that's even a safe thing to use at the moment. So the Dropbox one definitely seems better. The iCloud Drive one seems fine. It's working very reliably for me. But the Google one, it simply cannot, I mean, in my experience anyway, it doesn't give you accurate folder counts. So it will say one item for every folder, even if there are 1,000 files in the folder. And then after you navigate 3 or 4 folders, it just says content could not be loaded. Essentially, the plugin crashes and the files app just tries to show you some helpful information. So when that gets here, a year from now, it's going to be great, but it's not there yet.
All right. Next, iPhone 10. So
well, only you can really talk about this.
Yeah. I've got mine. My wife has hers. I love the size. After, a month or maybe a month and a half, 6 weeks of having Face ID, I like Face ID, but I do miss Touch ID, if that makes sense.
Why do you say that?
It fails more than Touch ID ever did. And, I have sunglasses on it's not like awful. It's like Face ID worked like 99.99% of the time. Face ID is, I would say, 92% of the time for me.
Okay.
And maybe it'll get better over time.
Mm-hmm.
But the no home button doesn't bother me at this point in the slightest. But the no touch ID does at times. Does it, if that makes sense?
How do you feel about the sort of variations in iPhone behavior because of the Face ID stuff, like not showing notification content until you're looking at the phone, or dimming the sounds when you're looking at the phone and things like that? Does that seem normal? Does that just behave the way you expect?
I like that. How, like, I doesn't, you know, if you pick up my phone, you don't see notification content until I look at it. I do like that.
Yeah.
It's overall, it's a win. And again, this is comparing Face ID 1 to Touch ID 2. Touch ID wasn't always that good.
True.
And Face ID will get a lot better, I'm sure, a lot faster. I mean, for version 1, it's great. But, yeah. So, overall, love the phone. My wife likes her. Camera's fantastic. Love the size. If there was a plus-size version of that next year, I don't know that I would buy it.
Mm-hmm.
It just really depends on if the camera was better. If the camera was better, I'll always go. If there was, like, a iPhone 10 to the second power plus, I don't know.
It's hard to see how the cameras could be any better than the ones on the 10. I mean, it's got all the toys. I mean, that actually is the best camera, even if it's not the biggest physical phone. You've got stabilization on both lenses on the iPhone 10, for example, where you've only got it on the wide angle on the Plus phone. So it's pretty great package all in.
Next thing is AirPods. This is obviously released December of last year. It was tough to get for most of this year. They are kind of, I think I checked last night, you can get it within 7 business days, I think. But I'm sure that's just holiday rush.
Yeah.
Love mine. My wife loves hers. The only thing I wish there was like a athletic version. I mean, so they're fine for occasional workouts. I would not recommend them. They're not sweatproof, I guess, is the thing I would say. I think Serenity Caldwell had an article about that on iMore here recently. They're not sweatproof. Again, occasional workouts, you're walking, that's fine. But if you run marathons consistently, I would not use them. Again, here and there, they're fine. But I notice, and I know multiple people, that after like about 8 months of using them in fitness situations, they sort of getting flaky. Apple replaced mine under warranty, and now I use Power Beats 3 for my workouts, and they are sweat resistant. So, again, occasional workouts, they are fine, though.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, not that I'm using them really for workouts, but the one thing I would love, Bradley, for AirPods is that they came in black rather than white. I don't know. There's something about the aesthetic of AirPods that hasn't quite landed for me. You know, whenever I sort of catch myself in the mirror wearing AirPods, I'm kind of like, who's that fancy guy with the earrings in, you know? It's got this little silvery bit dangling from my ear, you know? And I think if there was a black version with matte black, I would probably go out and buy them on the first day just for the aesthetics of them. But functionality-wise, outstanding. Can't rate them highly enough.
And I would pay more for like a fitness version. I'd pay $249 or $199 or whatever.
Yeah.
If it costs more. Series 3 Apple Watch was another new product this year. I picked one up and works well. I think the cellular to me is still the killer feature for this thing. I use the cellular function every day. Every day if I go to lunch, don't take my phone. If I go work out at lunch, phone doesn't come with me. Now that it's out, I can talk about it. Workouts Plus Plus from Underscore Dave Smith has been released, and it now has podcast support in it. So, quickly on why podcasts are hard on Apple Watch, that apps cannot run in the background indefinitely unless they're workout apps, and getting files to the Apple Watch is often very difficult. And so because Workouts Plus Plus is a workout app, it is very easy to add that. Not easy, but it's like it fits in the vision, where the Overcast send a watch, it was just tricky.
Yeah.
Now, sending and Workouts Plus Plus is great. You can customize your workout interface. Like, it's a fantastic app, and it's free. So it is great. It's Workouts Plus Plus. We'll have a link in the show notes. But if you have a cellular Apple Watch, you don't even have to sync. You can just download off your cellular connection. It's really great. Syncing can be trouble. problematic. Good tip if you're trying to sync. If you don't have a Series 3 watch and you're trying to sync, you turn off your Bluetooth on your phone and it'll download. It'll send it over Wi-Fi, so it's much, much faster.
Okay.
Yeah, and I guess if you really want a podcast playback without your phone, you could just like start an outdoor walk and just start walking. But again, I think it'll probably drain a little bit more battery life because it'll be you doing more heart rate stuff. But yeah, it works well. You can do 2x playback. It has this trim silence. It, you know, there's a built-in inside the iPhone app. There's a built-in thing to add all your podcasts, or you can export it out of the Overcast or Pocket Cast or whatever you use, and works well. I mean, again, if you want podcasts on your while you're running, Workouts Plus Plus is how to do it right now. So
very cool. I mean, I think the Apple Watch Series 3, I would say, is like the most improved Apple product of 2017. I mean, I had an original Apple Watch, I had a Series 1 Apple Watch, and then I went to the Series 3, and the difference in performance, even from the Series 2 to the Series 3, is like night and day. I don't have the cellular version, I just have the GPS version, but the way that Siri works on the Series 3 watch is probably the best Siri there's ever been on any platform. I would actually argue that it's better than Siri on the iPhone. It is very accurate. It hears me really well. I think there must be really good microphones on the watch. I don't know, but they seem to do an excellent job of hearing me. Maybe it's just because it's closer to my mouth. I don't know. Whenever I start talking to my wrist or whatever, but it's fast. It's very responsive and it talks back to you and it does a really good job. So I think it's hard to actually overstate how much better it is than even Series 2. It's like night and day, even from that version as well. So yeah, huge thumbs up to the Series 3 Apple Watch.
So the rest of the show, let's quickly talk about kind of the iPad lineup. So we've got 5th generation iPad, the 10.5-inch iPad Pro was released this year. Obviously, the new 12.9-inch, and both of those added the ProMotion displays. And then there's the weird status of the iPad Mini. So 5th generation iPad you could find around this time of year for as low as $249 for a 32 gigabyte, and that is a great iPad. It has an I think an A8 or an A8X processor, one of the two, but it's very
I think
competent.
It's more than like, that. Is it not A10?
I thought it was an A8.
I think it's more up to date than that. I think it's the equivalent of the first generation iPad Pro, I think. Or maybe
I'm Googling it really quickly. Of course, it's a 9.7-inch screen. Mm-hmm. But so that's obviously like the original size. And, oh, it's an A9. So we were both wrong.
A9, okay. So it wasn't as good as that, but it was one generation older than the first generation iPad Pro. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and it is, I don't think it's the iPad if you want to go iPad only, but if you want an iPad for light usage, for reading, for movies, on the go, like that's a great, great iPad at an incredible price. 32 gigabytes works for a lot of people. Now, the rumor is there's going to be a non-on-sale iPad coming in 2018. Is that an iPad Mini? Is that like an iPad Mini with these specs? That I don't know, but the iPad Mini is in a weird spot. But if they can get this iPad down to $249 retail, that is huge.
To me, that's what's got to happen, Bradley. I think they've got to really aggressively deal with Chromebook in the education space, and it seems to me that this is very clearly like the education iPad. You know, if that iPad had been out in 2016, we would not have iPad Pros in our hands right now. I can tell you that, because for everything we want to do in school, apart from Apple Pencil support, that iPad is exactly what you want. It's got the memory, it's got the processor, it's got all the radios you need, it's got the screen you need, everything. And the only thing I kind of wish it had was Apple Pencil support, but it's an outstanding iPad for school. And they've got the 32 gig model for one-to-one deployments and the 128 for shared iPad deployments. And it's very difficult to see how you would even think about looking past that for student use at this point.
Yeah, especially if they had the education pricing at $229, $239, even a little bit cheaper. Obviously, no tax for schools. That's a great device. Again, not the latest specs, but I'm fine with that. You've obviously got the 10.5-inch iPad Pro is a great device. And really, with those, the specs are the same with that and the 13-inch. And it's really just deciding which side screen you want. The main reason that you would go 13-inch is if you wanted to be if you wanted two full-size iPad apps side by side. Otherwise, the 10.5 is an incredible, incredible device. Both those have the ProMotion displays, which I saw one today, and again, it just always blows my mind how much better they are. I don't have an iPad that has that, and It does look fantastic. Do I need that in a school deployment? No, but it is really, really nice.
Do you know what?
iPad lineup, go ahead.
I honestly can't tell the difference between ProMotion and non-ProMotion iPads. I mean, I deal with non-ProMotion iPads all day because the 9.7 Pro doesn't have that screen, and I honestly cannot tell a single bit of difference between the two. It's maybe I'm just blind or something, or I don't get it, but I don't know. It seemed like everybody made such a fanfare about it at the time because it was the new thing, but I don't really get it.
I guess it's like you're getting old and you're like the person that couldn't tell the difference between Retina and non-Retina. Getting in.
Yeah, well, maybe not that bad, but I do use a non-Retina computer screen at work sometimes, and so what?
But yeah, the iPad mini is the weird spot because they obviously still sell it. You know, obviously it's on deep discounts at Christmas. It's still a good device. I think the iPad mini needs pencil support more than the fifth generation iPad needs pencil support.
That would be interesting. Yeah. I think Apple just wants rid of the iPad mini. I really do. I think
you're right. I think you're right. It's not so much. I would question, is it because of a price point? If they can get the 9.7 inch down to 249, yep. And that's a better iPad experience overall, than a mini.
Yeah. Except for very specific demographics, like I'm using it as a carry-around terminal in an airport to help people or something like that. You know, for very niche use cases, maybe the mini makes sense, but I think that the mini is a product from a time when smartphones were very small. And they're not very small anymore. I mean, almost nobody is carrying a smartphone, you know, that's smaller than iPhone 7 size, or at least new ones. And, you know, the iPad mini is a product from a time when you may have had like a 3.5 to 4 inch iPhone, and then you had something bigger to, I don't know, watch video on. But nowadays, it's too definite, but a lot of that kind of casual browsing and casual media consumption is all being done on a smartphone now, and people are quite happy with that. So, you know, would you put down your phone and pick up your iPad mini just to watch a video? No. But would you pick up, you know, a large iPad to do a bit of work? Yeah, absolutely you would.
So, yeah, we'll see what happens in 2018, but overall, good lineup finishing out the year, and good price points all around for consumers as well.
Yeah, I think overall, Bradley, I think it's been a pretty decent year for Apple hardware-wise. The accessories, I think, have been probably the strongest. You know, we're praising heavily the AirPods, we're praising the Apple Watch really heavily. The iPhone X is a remarkable success considering, you know, when you deal with a product at the scale of the iPhone and you make almost any change to it, it's almost inevitable that people are going to hate it. But people seem to just love the iPhone X, and I think That in itself is remarkable. We can say, you know, first generation Face ID and so on and so on. But I think in general, the fact that Apple has produced a radically different phone that is still very well received by the market is a huge achievement in itself.
Yeah, I would agree there. And that they still do have the 8 and 8 Plus. And I have friends that bought the 8. I mean, you see the buy one, get one free iPhone 8. Wow. The retail stores here now, like AT&T and Verizon, are running that for Christmas, and it's still a great phone. Same processor.
Are you doing any wireless charging?
I am not. I mean, it's like one of those. If someone gave me one as a Christmas present, I would use it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I just haven't really. It's like seems like something else to buy.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like something you need on day one of ownership. But
yeah, I mean, again, if someone bought it for me as a Christmas gift or something, I would use it. I guess it'd be nice at work. I probably wouldn't use it at night, but I'd probably use it at work, like on my desk. Mm-hmm. It'd be just easy to throw it on mm-hmm. there instead of having to plug it up if I needed it. But yeah, I mean, I think it's great that it has it. I'm more excited about it where if I go to a hotel room, I don't have to like get out my charger. I mean, I'm still always going to take a charger because you're going to need one. But like if I just, you know, throw it on the nightstand, I don't have to like look for a plug behind the bed or some weird thing like that.
One thing I saw that I really liked was that there's a Qi wireless charging battery where one surface of the battery is a Qi charger. So you just put the battery pack down wherever you are and put the phone on top of the battery pack and it starts charging without a cable. I thought, yeah, when I'm traveling, that is pretty cool.
Of course, the downside is it's slower.
That's the downside. But I don't know what size the battery is. I think it's not much bigger than the phone. So you could conceivably just sort of slip them back to back inside your pocket and just, you know, have charging as you walk around without looking like you've got a catheter bag coming out of your pocket or something like you normally do in those situations. So, yeah, It's an interesting thing to see develop. I think it's very early days for all of that right now, but it would be great to see more of that.
Well, I guess we'll wrap it up there for 2017. Thanks, everybody, for listening this year. We'll get back started recording in 2018, and hope everybody has a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and a Happy New Year.
Amen.